So last time, we made the observation based on Haeckel's ideas that, as he said, the human being has traveled from the Annelida 540 million years ago, through all the phyletic lines of development up to the present. Of course, the human being wasn't there in the Annelida, but the idea that that we bring from this conception of descent is that of a continuum of intricately connected developments from the origin of life until the present. The picture that emerges from the science of evolution is an evolutionary continuum that diversifies gradually over an immense span of time. If we think about the idea of unity and diversity, the idea of Oroville as a laboratory of evolution based upon a notion of unity in diversity. And we contemplate Sri Aurobindo's idea that that unity exists. It's not something to be created. Then possibly the study of evolution and an awareness of the intricate, absolute interconnectedness of everything could enable us to gain a sense of what unity in diversity really means. When we think about that odd word, which is probably pronounced hox and not hoax, when we think about the hox gene, which we all share with absolutely every chordate species, which determines the body plan of each of those species. Or if we think about that Pax VI gene, you'll read about these in your blue book if you get that far, which makes the eye develop in every different type of creature that has an eye, from the earliest eye spot in the paramecium, which happens in 1.4 billion years ago, from that earliest eye spot to all the different types of eyes.
I'm sorry, excuse me, what is it cost? What does it mean?
What does what mean?
Hox.
It's a gene, Hox gene. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything, except that it is a certain nucleotide chain. Okay. There's a nucleotide chain called the Hox gene, and there's another one called the Pax6 gene, and there are 30,000 others in the human being, which are identified combinations of DNA molecules. So if we contemplate that this structure, this molecular structure, persists in all of our cells and in every cell of every living thing, every animal, and it has been there since the very beginning of one-celled organisms, except that the difference is that in the worm, or in the earliest one-celled organism, there was one Hox gene, and in the human being there are 38. But in every species, in every phyletic lineage, this gene determines the development of the body, where the head goes and where the tail goes, and the general abdominal structure and thoracic structure and head structure. This structural development is stimulated by that gene in all animals. So that is a kind of unity that we share with untold thousands of species. We share other types of unity, such as with higher chordates, we share this body plan that we inhabit. We don't share this body plan with spiders and starfish. But spiders and starfish are there in the phyletic lineage of which we are an end result. And so each of those body plans that we discussed last time, from the worm to the starfish, to the insect, to the fish, to the shrew, each of those body plans, and there are about as many of them as there are Hox genes, there are about 38 different body plans that have been identified in the fossil record. Each one develops according to the stimulation at a particular time in the embryonic process when it's appropriate for the head to form, and another stimulation of the creation of enzymes occurs from this locus on the chromosome at a slightly different time when the chest should develop and the abdomen should develop and the tail should develop and the legs should appear. Just as in the PAX6 gene, when the eye starts to develop, that gene stimulates the protein processing that leads to the formation of that structure, which is a group of cells that have a function. So this is a kind of unity. And if we are naturalists and we observe in nature lizards and insects and birds and cats and mongooses and so on, if we observe them closely, we start to recognize behaviors that are very familiar to us. It's an incredible experience, actually, and in this environment it's quite easy to have such an experience, because you have time, and there are not a lot of distractions out in the forest. And so you can actually take the time to get to know your local termite colony and your local mongoose and some of your other
squirrels.
Yeah. So normally in civilization we do this with pets, and pets are largely a product of human selectivity, and so we don't notice it as such a natural phenomenon. But in nature itself, you can really experience an identity with creatures. And you can realize that you share not only structures, but behaviors. So if we concentrate on similarities among species, or similarities among a species, the individuals in a species, like this room full of human beings, if we concentrate on our similarities, we can experience a very profound identity. We look alike, breathe alike, walk alike, react to different stimuli very similarly. And so we understand our oneness as human beings. We understand ourselves as members of a group with a common purpose also. But if we look at our differences, then we'll think, how could we possibly be products of the same genes, virtually the same genes? Because none of us is even a little bit like the other one in many, many details. So we tend in our thinking to reflect this dual nature of reality. There is a way of looking at things which reveals unity of form and structure, type, species, thought patterns, behavior patterns. And there's another way of looking at things which reveals the infinite differences in everything. So we can go either way in our research, in our study, in our development. And in science in particular, it is possible to move endlessly through the realms of difference, and only to occasionally group things according to similarities. And this is precisely what evolutionary science does. It scrutinizes every single difference. And so we come up, when we follow that kind of thinking, we can come to, I'll come back to this Hox gene in a minute, but we can come to a kind of understanding of genetics which yields information like this. Can you see it? Should I enlarge it a little bit? So I go to view. That's what I do. And
yeah, full screen.
Okay, full screen.
And then you can press and no. And then yeah, you can go anywhere with that here. Yeah.
Is that big enough? So this is called, this concept is known as heterozygosity. It is the immense variation within our own gamete structures, our own chromosomes, the seeds that we produce, that reproduce us, can be this diverse. Techniques for determining heterozygosity have been used to investigate numerous species of plants and animals. Consider, as an example, humans, whose level of variation is about the same as that of other mammals. The human heterozygosity value at the level of proteins is stated as H equals about 700s, which means that an individual is heterozygous at 6.7% of his genes, because the two genes at each locus encode slightly different proteins. The Human Genome Project demonstrated that there are at least 30,000 genes in humans. This means that a person is heterozygous at no fewer than 30,000 times 6.7% equals 2,000 gene loci. An individual heterozygous at one locus can produce two different kinds of sex cells or gametes, one with an allele A cap and A small. An individual heterozygous at two loci, AA and BB, can produce four kinds of gametes. At two in different gametes, every human individual has the potential to produce 2 to the power of 2,000, or approximately 10 with 605 zeros following it, different kinds of sex cells. Every one of them, every one of this many hundreds of thousands of chromosomes, has a different arrangement of genes on it. And when that gene divides and recombines with its partner gene, one out of those tens of millions of possibilities will result. It is clear then that no two persons who ever existed or will ever exist are likely to be genetically identical, with the exception of identical twins who come from the same set of cells, of genes. The same conclusion applies to all organisms that reproduce sexually. So, if we have any skepticism about the ability of different phyletic lineages to produce innumerable varieties in each generation, we should lose that skepticism on the basis of genetic information. Just because all of the butterflies look the same to us doesn't mean that they're all the same. And the fact that hippopotami and buffalo and pigs and cows and human beings have all descended from shrews shouldn't be so amazing to us if we have a perspective on the infinite variety that is produced in every single generation of every species. And so Darwin observed that as a result of these infinite variations which accumulate, which recombine, and if there is any slight advantage, reproduce themselves a few more times and then reproduce themselves exponentially, at some point there may be an accumulation of variation which enhances the survivability of a certain group under changing environmental conditions. In long periods of time, that group may become different enough from its parent group that it can no longer interbreed. And one of the things that helps along the way is if there is a major earth change and they cannot even associate with each other anymore. They become isolated. So varieties throughout time have periodically become isolated from their own parent lineages, and then completely new lines of development have become possible. And the main factor in that possibility is the environment. The environment changes. Species that move out into other environments, other niches, find a niche which is comfortable and survivable, start to eat another kind of food, start to live on a drier kind of soil. And Darwin says that there is an inherited effect from such environmental changes. And he gives the example of plants that are moved from one environment to another and produce different colors of flowers, or grow more profusely, or taller, or whatever. He gives the example of the domestic duck, which developed lighter wing bones and heavier leg bones as a result of not needing to fly. He gives the example of the mole shrew, which as a result of burrowing eventually loses eyesight and develops forelimbs that are different from other shrews and mice in that they are modified for digging. And we saw last time the horse.
Rod, just one second. This is the 30,000 genes in human beings. You were referring to these figures all suggesting the amount of variety that's possible based on those 30,000 different genes in the 2010 gene loci, blah, 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 from that calculation. Does it stand to reason that through different animals, obviously different animals have different numbers of genes, so is that correlated in any way by size, or?
By size?
I don't know, this question.
No.
Right.
Well, human beings have more than all other species except for gorillas.
And so I'm presuming also that the fewer the number of genes, the less variety actually a species will produce, or has the potential to produce. Is that correct?
Maybe. If you think about the variety of human beings that have been produced, it's infinitely greater because we fill every niche on the earth, whereas the hippopotamus is pretty much confined to the river. But the hippopotamus is pretty close to the human being. And so structurally, there is a high degree of diversity there, although it's not behavioral diversity. I think the number of genes is not particularly smaller in the hippopotamus than in the human being. What happens in the human being is that there's a leap in consciousness, and our ability to make choices and to adapt to different environments is much, much greater than that of the hippopotamus. And so diversification among lower species has resulted in speciation. Diversification in the human being has not yet resulted in speciation. It has resulted in an infinite variety of human beings who can adapt to every different niche. So if we were less adaptable, then we might have become confined earlier to some niche, and there might be another species that had succeeded us sooner.
It resulted in speciation in the sense of Neanderthal or Homo erectus or whatever. But just in the time we did Homo sapiens sapiens, it's developed more within the species.
Yes, we've developed within the species an enormous variety which has not resulted in speciation.
Since we became
Homo sapiens. So we have a picture here of the human beings that have preceded us.
Should make it bigger.
I'm moving in that direction. I wanted to look at the horse too, as an example.
Without control.
Last time we observed the horse, and this is an example of a member, a relative of ours, who only 50 million years ago was this tall. Human beings have been around a little bit longer than that. And so in that relatively short period of time, apparently this fellow moved to drier ground and needed to be able to run from predators and develop jaws capable of chewing dry grass and leaves and bark and so on. So we can see in the fossil record the process of variation, not speciation, but variation, which happens to a very large extent. I mean, this is an enormous range of variation in one species. And if you're a horse lover, you know that the earth right now is populated with an extraordinary variety of horses. And they're also very intelligent. So the other way of looking at this problem you can look at our more immediate relatives here. See if I can enlarge it a little bit more.
If
So this is okay like this. We are closely related to all of these guys. This one was 3 million years ago, Caenanthropus. Well, I'm not going to go over the. It isn't important to see the details here, actually, and you have it in your book. I just want to quickly look at the way that these early humans from 3 million years ago moved across here to Homo habilis and Homo ergaster, who became Homo erectus. These two guys overlapped and interbreeded. These guys overlap and interbreed. And these guys overlap and interbreed. And so eventually we get to Homo erectus, who appears to have moved in the direction of Heidelbergensis with Neanderthalus. Neanderthalus genes are apparently there in the human being. So there was some interbreeding going on here, and ultimately this guy is the one who survived. And his brain was considerably larger than these guys' brains here. So he actually appeared recognizably around 50,000 years ago. 40 to 50,000 years ago, he was pretty much the final result of this movement. Now, another way of looking at this question of diversification of species is known as the punctuated equilibrium view. And I want to go to that for tonight for a while. It doesn't look like we're going to get to Sri Aurobindo tonight. This timeline is similar to the one that was there before. It shows a few of the mass extinctions which occurred, not all of them. There were, you know, that list over there represents mass extinctions from, let's go back to that one for a minute. So according to the punctuated equilibrium view, earlier life, when the Cambrian explosion took place, which was an explosion of arthropoda, shelled creatures, from which come crustaceans and insects, there was an explosion of species at this time. This is between 670 and 700. There was an earlier saw species called Ediacara that exists in the fossil record, but it's not at all clear what the relationship is between those guys and the ones that suddenly occurred here. And when this Cambrian explosion took place in seas all over the world, it suddenly consisted of more different phyla than now exist. And at this point, 85% of those species became extinct. And from them grew the forerunners of the 38 species, I mean the 38 phyla that now exist. All of them can be traced back to these guys. All the body plans, everything was there in the Cambrian period as far as genes and body plans go.
So when you have 85% extinction after the explosion, then the next one you have 83%.
Yes.
Does that mean that 83% of the 15% that were left were extinct? Or was there another explosion in between?
No. There's another explosion that happens here, and this is what makes the theory of punctuated equilibrium so interesting. Because between this extinction and this extinction, there was a great explosion of our early ancestor known as the annelida worm. This is the Silurian period, and many sea creatures grew up into existence at that time without shells. And then there was another massive extinction, and as a result of it, there was another explosion of shellfish and other kinds of fish. And then there was the famous Permian extinction, after which grew all of the reptiles. The dinosaur age followed the Permian extinction, where 95% of life of animal life became extinct.
Excuse me, when you just before Ediacara, you mean 700 billion of years? What is that?
Yes, 700 to 607 million years ago.
Okay.
This is 500 million, 400, okay. 360 million, 286 million. So life itself has been evolving in its great variety only since about this time. Prior to that, there were one-celled organisms, and prior to that, there were bacteria and viruses. All the way back to 3.5 billion years ago, there were early life forms that were not yet organized into cells. Then there was a long period of time, 1.4 billion years almost, when there were only one-celled organisms. And then suddenly, there was this Cambrian explosion, and there were multi-celled animals with all the body plans that now exist. But they were all shellfish, more or less. Then they became extinct, almost totally, but enough survived that there was another diversification of species and classes and phyla, which took place during this 50 million years or so, another massive extinction, and then another 150 million years of diversification, and another massive extinction. And Steve Gould suggests that when these extinctions occur, suddenly all of the niches become empty. And so this rapid diversification can take place more quickly at that edge of time. And as more niches become filled, the possibilities for diversification recede. So he calls this punctuated equilibrium.
So does that suggest that the mass extinction that we're heading for next is actually a positive thing from an evolutionary perspective?
It may suggest that. If the past is any indication, if you consider that each of these stages of evolution has constituted an improvement on the past, then history tells us that the next we are in, as everyone tells us, as all of these writers that are in the 20th century tell us, especially in the last 40 years, we are in the midst of a mass extinction period now.
We just have to look up out of the 10th.
And if you want to look up the Living Planet Report, which was published in October 2 years ago, the Living Planet Report has tracked species for 30 years, and every 10 years has produced a Living Planet Report. And they have found that about 25 and 30% of chordata has become extinct in the last 25 years. Vertebrates. Chordata is the phylum vertebrata. Yeah. So we, and this has been the theme of Wilson's, E.O. Wilson's work for many decades, that we are in the midst of an extinction event now, which is 100% due to human beings invading every niche and upsetting the balance of habitats. And we also are creating a global warming situation that is causing the extinction of species much more rapidly than it was in the last 25 years, because it upsets feeding patterns. You know, the migratory species find that the food isn't there that they normally expect to eat. It's already, the insects have already proliferated and died before the birds get there. And so this is a study which is quite thorough and ongoing, and there's plenty of information about it available to everyone. So, one curious thing that has been discovered just in the last 40 years or so is that many of these extinction cycles have corresponded to Earth changes. And so you might be surprised to know that the Ordovician period, during the Ordovician period, the Earth looked like this. And in the very next geologic period, the Devonian, it looked like this. Siberia is moving north, and Gondwana, which is the largest land body, is moving north, and Laurasia is moving along in between, but Laurasia was separated by this Panthalassa ocean. Ocean everywhere, Panthalassa. And then in the late Jurassic, early Cretaceous, it gets to look like this. So Laurasia has become North America, and Gondwana is moving towards South America and Africa aren't yet divided. Australia and Asia are not yet connected. This plate is moving in that direction. This plate is moving in that direction. So this science of plate tectonics was only discovered in the 60s. And the Cambrian explosion was only discovered in the 60s and 70s also. So in
how fast does these plates move, actually? How fast do they
Well, it looks like, if you think about the time frame, the time change between the Devonian and the Ordovician, it's about 100 million years.
That's a long time.
And the period of time when the dinosaurs became extinct is in the midst of this. I mean, the dinosaurs were moving around during this Cretaceous period, I think. Let's look at that.
What kind of evidence do they have for that kind of development?
It's very interesting, and it's another subject. There's a lot of evidence. It's in comparing rock formations. The plates have been determined by satellite photography, and the movements of the plates have been analyzed on the basis of the movement of land from below the surface to the surface, from below the plates, which are 70 miles thick. There's lava coming up and pushing them apart. The Himalayas can be measured. They grow a couple of centimeters every year as a result of the Australian plate pushing India up against them. And so there's ongoing evidence of this phenomenon.
I appreciate that. All the maps, they're pretty, I would imagine they must be fairly loose. It's kind of like filling that first one. How do we get from that? Or the Visian map, the present day, that's quite a stretch of the imagination.
Well,
I'm suggesting it's wrong.
It's not just a stretch of the imagination. There are land formations that support this view. And also species locations, fossil locations. Where were they then? And how could they, like, where were these fossils, which are closely related to these fossils and these fossils, after they have been found in North America and South America and Asia, you know, at, how were they related at that time? And how did they get around if there had been big oceans like there are now, divided by continents? So there's genetic evidence, there's carbon dating and fossils and so on.
I can appreciate how Guyana and South America were connected. South America and Africa.
Okay, so the point is that I'd like to come back to a kind of way of thinking, because we can choose to become geologists and paleontologists, and we can choose to become biologists and evolutionary ecologists, and we can go on indefinitely discovering patterns of the physical environment of life.
What is interesting on this is to open our mind that this thinking
yes.
of continents right. of Earth was always there and it is
right.
It's nice to see the rock found separate.
Both of these, what I want to, the way I would like to sum it up is that both the standard Darwinian gradualism of species variation eventually becoming speciation as a result of the infinite variety of differences that are produced in every generation, plus landmass changes which isolate species. You know, we can follow that Darwinian gradualism view quite easily and discover the relationships among all the species through time. We can also follow the punctuated equilibrium for the paleontological point of view and discover that there have been sudden explosions of species due to the openness of the niches, and also due to the fact that those who survived the previous extinction had not yet diversified into stable, large groups. And so Gould suggests that the genetic material itself is much more flexible at that period than it is after the diversification has become a species and has settled into a niche and has reproduced itself to its maximum potential over millions of years. Then it is no longer capable of that degree of diversification which existed after that previous extinction had taken place.
Special animals fell it and went upwards, so they fell. mean, that is also interesting to
So if Earth changes due to global warming really do result in sea level rise, then we will see a migration away from all of the coastlines, not only by human beings, but by other species. And a completely new environmental condition will be asking us to adapt. And some of us will adapt more easily than others. And in another few hundred years, without electricity, and with much more of the land covered by seas, our bodies will adjust.
When will we be?
Our yes, but if we had time to get to Sri Aurobindo tonight, in his reflections on this Darwinian picture, he speculates in the 20s, he already starts to speculate about this process of punctuated equilibrium, and he starts to question the process of natural selection itself. Not in the sense of doubting that it occurs at all, and not in the sense of questioning that heredity is the main process which connects each of the species. But he raises some very interesting questions about the psychology of the process. What's being carried forward, take for example between moles and hippopotami, what's being carried forward is not only physical structure, but it's what he refers to very cryptically as predispositions. Some of the moles are predisposed to that dark environment under the earth. Some of them are predisposed to live in marshy, wet environments, and some of them are predisposed to live in trees.
Excuse me, you mean
moles, these little shrews. Shrews. Okay. All of the geneticists today agree that we are the product of shrews. So some of those shrews became tree dwellers and primates. Some of them became wetland dwellers and hippopotami and buffalo and pigs.
Whales.
And some of them became whales.
But how did you connect more shrews with hippopotami?
Pardon me?
Why do you take that example of moles and hippopotami? It's quite so different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're different, but there's a very clear line of development.
Okay.
A very clear...
Millions years of distance.
Yes. And think about the time frame here that we're looking at. The difference between our age and all of the previous ones is that the late Cenozoic, which is referred to as the Quaternary, this enormous diversification that we know on Earth right now has happened just since the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago. So in just 65 million years, all the species that we know on Earth today have descended from common ancestors. I mean, there were reptiles and there were birds and there were fish in this Mesozoic period, but they were quite different than the reptiles and birds and fish that we see, and mammals that we see today, and there were hardly any mammals. So the chordate species have evolved enormous varieties of different species within a relatively short period of time, just 60 million years. And human evolution is traced back 5 million years.
And what about that little, very little dinosaur that I saw just coming? Is it a sort of surviving vestige? Of
yeah, he's a survivor from the from the Cenozoic period.
Cockroaches.
Right, and some fish. There are fish like what are they? I don't recall the name of them right now. But there are quite a few different varieties of fish that have very big jaws and very strong jaws and don't seem to look quite like fish.
Yeah.
Crocodiles also. Right. So there are many questions that can that pop up in a field of information like this, and those questions can lead to lifelong pursuits of comparative zoology and embryology and genetics and so on. But
excuse me, there's one question about reptiles. There was this whole trend about reptiles being embodied in human beings and so on. Is it not coming from the same kind of thinking?
You please read your your handbook. It will answer all of your questions. And it does not either ask or answer any philosophical questions. And so, philosophically, what do we do with all of this information about unity and diversity? Can we use this kind of information to give ourselves a more intimate sense of being connected to other life forms, human beings to start with? Can we learn to concentrate on the evolutionary behaviors that enhance survival? Because we belong to a single species whose existence may be threatened. And we can easily learn that the members of most species survive through cooperation. So there's another whole field of science which explores the behavior patterns of species that enhance their survivability. This is ethnology.
It's quite interesting that we are talking always about survival. It's all about survival, in which niche this particular spirit can endure and survive.
It's also about diversification. Diversification is the principle that Sri Aurobindo has hit upon as the most fundamental truth of nature. It's unity in diversity. It's not unification or uniformity. It is through diversity that the principle of unity is realized. It is through maximum differentiation that maximum unity is manifested.
And what sorry, excuse me. But so what is the, I don't know the word in English, denominator, the common denominator. So that's unity inside diversity. What is it exactly? Yeah.
There are many common denominators. What, you know, one common denominator is the genome. At the microscopic, at the submicroscopic molecular level, the genome is a unifying factor. At another level, consciousness, you know, the ability to make judgments that lead to success, group success, is very important. And there was a time, a bit in the past, when social groups understood very well their unity through language and culture, but they considered themselves enemies of the tribe on the other continent.
You're thinking about them?
I'm thinking about the French and the British, the Greeks and the Turks. Although they were drawn together by various factors, they considered themselves enemies. One group was barbaric, and the other group was the polis, you know, the family. Nowadays, because of interbreeding and intercultural sharing, we tend to see ourselves as members of one group. Even though we have all these physical differences and these cultural differences, which are much less prominent, and our psychological differences, we have different learning styles, we have these things that we brought from our parents and our cultures that Sri Aurobindo calls predispositions, that make some of us more right-brained or more left-brained, or make some of us naturalists and others artists and others politicians. You know, we have brought some streams of development from prior human ages forward to this point, and they have questionable validity at this point. Some of our political behaviors have questionable validity. Some of our family territorial behaviors have questionable validity. But we happen to have this flexibility of mind that allows us to recognize the limitations and make choices that favor our own survival and the survival of our groups. And we're able to see more and more clearly that war is probably not the best way to solve human problems. We can see solutions, other solutions, that are within reach, that simply require a slight shift in our predisposition towards beliefs and value systems, for example. Yes, it's still here, and in fact, everything is still here. All the behaviors, all the forms that have existed in the last 50 million years are more or less still present. So we are moving as a species towards a balancing of what we perceive to be the principle of unity and what we perceive to be the principle of diversity. And we are able to respect and to appreciate, to understand, and to explore farther and farther reaches of diversity up to the infinity, the infinite. Sri Aurobindo's final conclusion is that the truth of reality is that it is the infinite with a capital I. And that infinite includes everything. It excludes nothing. And it is one. If we can somehow grasp the relationship between the unity and the diversity, and the diversification, and yet the diversification leads to more clearly defined unities, then we might come eventually to what the mother struggled with
And he said that we are not finished yet.
Yeah.
They, both of them. So, where is that famous?
Philosophically, without going into the question of the future of human evolution, just what is possible for us right now on the basis of our knowledge and on the basis of the higher ranges of consciousness that we have given some clues about how to develop. One thing that we notice from studying biology is that I lost that train. The principle of diversity is ever-present and dynamic. Every species is changing constantly. And so the principle of diversification is not something abstract and unchanging. It is something that is dynamic and ongoing. Diversity is not a dead concept. It's very alive. The DNA is a dead molecule. It doesn't do anything. Yes. The DNA only is able to replicate itself as a result of the interaction with all of the proteins in the cell. It's the cell that is the unity, not the DNA. But let's just move for a minute from that perspective of infinite dynamic diversity, which is going on in all of us and in all species every minute, to the principles of unity that are always present at the same time. The genome is always present. And the same molecular structures have always been there and are there now. The underlying substratum of molecular structures is there now, and it has not changed, except that it has become created more complex molecules. The body plans that we inhabit are there now. The ability to identify ourselves outside of our physical structure with other similar entities, whether they be human beings or primates or insects or whatever, we have the ability to look at ourselves ecologically as members of a very complex physical, vital, and mental world continuum. And at the moment that we transcend the diversity and grasp the unity, we then see that there are stable forms and structures that underlie all of this immense diversity. And then we come up to the mother's challenge in 68 and 69. She attempted several different times to articulate this unification of the infinite energy and diversity and the absolute stable unity underlying her being and everything, the truth consciousness. And she asked this question, so how do we move between these two poles of pain and bliss? How is it that they both can exist at the same time? How can we live with this terrible primitive behaviors and contradictions, and at the same time realize that in fact everything is a harmony and everything is exactly as it must be? She had this argument with herself several times, and finally at the end of 1969 she said, there it is. It's there. The experience is there, the power is there, the knowledge is there, and here's how it looks. This is the supramental consciousness. And she wrote down five lines. So if I can open my document here, and I can go to Darwin and Sri Aurobindo. Yeah, I this is only going to take a couple of minutes. It's the one thing that I didn't previously download, this one. Just quietly contemplate for a moment this experience. All that we have discussed in these four meetings is the principles of stable form and the principles of dynamic diversification. We have looked back and forth from this perception of forms and structure and continuity and permanence to this perception of change and fluidity and diversity in response to these causes and those causes and the other causes, everything which is constantly changing, we have observed from different points of view, and we've always seen principles of stability and unity moving through these forms of ever-changing material structure. All the material structures of life have unfolded and are proceeding within the context of one pattern of principle and unification. There's, you know, there are patterns of unity, and within those patterns of unity, there is infinite diversity. And if we moved, if our consciousness moved towards something other than a mental survey, towards a direct grasp of the reality itself that we are a part of, we should experience an immovable, eternal, absolute, unmoving aspect, and an infinitely powerful and diverse and ever-changing transformational aspect. And we should be able to hold both of those in ourselves, not as concepts, but as the two principles of our being. The stable and eternal, and the material, energetic, infinitely creative, ever-changing, plastic nature. This is Purusha and Prakriti, and they are ever present in every moment, and have always been, and cannot exist other than in this continuum of unity and diversity.
Isn't it the basis of quantum science?
Yeah. This is the basis of philosophy also.
I'm sorry, when you say, you say the cell is living and DNA is in sort of dead, but the cell, DNA is inside the cell. DNA, yes. made the cell, no? So, why do you divide the... You know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. And it's...
I'm not scientific, but...
Yeah, and it's... This one of the illusions of the Human Genome Project is that by analyzing the DNA chains, we discover something about life. And actually, what we're talking about now is something called development. Each species has a broad spectrum of phenotypic flexibility, which doesn't get stimulated into existence because the species settles into a niche. But as soon as the species is exposed to new conditions, it starts to diversify. And so the human being is capable of a much vaster range of responses than we realize, because that genetic pattern that we carry is infinitely diverse, and it only develops in response to the environment. So the genes themselves only stimulate change when they enter into an environmental context. They are not driving the car. It's the relationship between the stimulating environment and the genetic pattern that is driving the car.
There is a motor, but they drive the car.
And what is the motor? This is the big question. We know what determines the direction of the car, but we don't really know who's driving. So the Human Genome Project has proven that the genes are not driving the car. It's what happens out here in life that's driving the car. Natural selection happens in the phenotypic world. We decide which environment is suitable to us, and so did the shrew. And And then that decision gets communicated through heredity.
But heredity is not all.
So, Purusha and Prakriti look like this when the consciousness is able to balance these two extremely opposite principles that are completely dependent on each other.
And she said that death exists, pain exists because we are conscious of it. If we are not, it will not exist.
So one is stimulated to understand many things which are mysterious. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.